philosophy of pregnancy, what would that be? Everyone who's ever lived is a result of pregnancy, if you will, but there's remarkably little written about it. We know a lot about the stages of fetal development, or what the mother might be expected to feel or experience at certain points. But what does it all mean? What wisdom is there waiting to be expressed? That's what I'm trying to find out in this series. And helping me is Karin Eglinton, coach and mentor at Intergifted. My name is Miriam van der Valk. And for the second part, our focus is pregnancy as faith. So some things happened since our last recording.
Just something.
Yeah, a little thing. I'm not pregnant anymore.
Yeah.
Because the baby came 3 weeks early, very quickly. She was in a rush to get it. Yeah.
So would your due date have actually been around now?
Yeah, that was on Friday. Friday the 13th.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, that's very funny. And she escaped it by a large
That's
margin.
Why.
Yeah.
She heard you. She's like, I'm not being born on Friday the 13th.
Yeah, she got it. She had it all planned because one of the things that I've put in my notes for today, today's episode, Pregnancy is Faith, is that the baby is the one who creates the placenta and sets in motion its own birth. Isn't it?
Agency so early on.
Yes, it is. And I think it's so cool. I've talked about it so many times already, but every time I mention it, it's like something is triggered in my mind. I just think it's mind-blowing.
And so do you want to talk more about it? Like, say why it's so mind-blowing? Woo.
It just became, it was so obvious when this little daughter was born, because it came right after I had been, I had had a fever for 5 days. And it was sort of these 5 days started off being me being very worried that something was wrong or that the baby would die. You know, I'm always taking things up to 11, so to speak. But then as I sort of was more and more sick, I started to think, okay, this is nothing I can do. At the moment, I have to just be in this sickness and trust. So it's very pregnancy is faith.
Yes.
Yeah.
And faith that she would choose her. Well, I don't know. You didn't know that before. You found that out later. That she would be the one choosing her own timing.
Yeah, I don't remember, but I don't remember when I heard that. It's all muddled up. I'm also I don't know anything about time anymore. I look at the time and then suddenly 2 hours has passed and I'm like, when did I look at? Because I also have to keep track of feeding times at least. But I never know. Was it 4? Was it 6? What time is it now? I've never been this confused.
I see. Yeah. That's the phase you're in, and that's it's a special space. It's like an in-between space.
Yes.
Yeah. I was wondering, I mean, I have a few thoughts, but I was wondering if we could actually talk about the word faith first, because it's such a loaded word.
Yeah, that's very good. That's how you would do it if you were a disciplined philosopher, which I am apparently not at the moment. But you start by defining the words you're going to use.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you, Karin.
You're welcome. I'll be the voice of reason today.
Good. We need one, and it's not going to be me.
Okay, so what are your thoughts on faith?
Faith is the, maybe simply put, it's this other power or something, the sort of what I can't, it involves concepts like surrender and like diminishing the ego, things like that, the sort of, but also perspective and
maybe. Like, perspective as in the entire world isn't just in my head, and it's not just my conscious conception, my ego world. Yeah.
Yes.
So what do you think?
What do I think? I have an interesting relationship with the word faith because, well, I grew up in a very religious country, first of all.
Yes.
But
doesn't mean that there's a lot of faith, though, right?
No, there doesn't, but there's a lot of talking about faith.
Ah!
Like, not that anybody has it, but there was a lot of talking about it, and that you needed to have it, and therefore it just became a stand-in for anything. Precisely because of what you're saying, because precisely because there was no real faith, no sense of real relationship with that other power for everybody. I mean, there were people who were genuinely filled with faith, but not everybody. And so then I came to a completely different country and engaged in a completely different spiritual activity, which was shamanic in nature. And there, one of the teachers used to say that faith, I mean, it was just his own definition. It was completely idiosyncratic. But he used to say that faith was different from trust, because trust could be blind. But faith is something that you have when you already know that there's somebody or something on the other side. So it's like, it's not blind trust. And I thought that was a really interesting and weird way of putting it.
But that's very nice. That's very nice. I was thinking about it when I was talking earlier that it's not faith and surrender in my mind at least does not mean that you become a stupid stupid someone who doesn't think at all anymore. You know, this is not
a
surrender.
Blind follower. And so it's really interesting because when we talk about pregnancy, of course, there's a tried and true process happening over millions of years, perfected process.
Yes, the baby will come out. That is one thing we know.
You have good chances. And so there's faith for sure. And there's a sense, I'm sure, of like not knowing what's happening and feeling blind, or there's so much that you can't control. But at the same time, there's this tried and true process that has a power of its own. So it's not blind faith.
It's not blind faith. It's very active faith, because you can also help it. You know, there are certain like you can do these movements, or you can exercise for 5 minutes every day also during your pregnancy. Things will be a lot easier. And I know, because I did this time and I didn't in my other pregnancy 10 years ago.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So there are things. It's an active faith that you can help, that you have this kind of, for lack of better formulation, a positive attitude, that you go, okay, so this is what I'm doing now. I'm going to push this forward, this motion forward that is already happening. Like, I'm on the on the wave. I'm not. I'm going to sort of make sure I'm on top of it and moving forward. You know,
That's good. That's good. Yeah. That's wonderful.
Yes. So that I think the certainly in my case, when I was worried in the first days of my fever, which was just like basically the day the fever ended, I had got the contractions that night, you know, when I was worried, when I had this, the first days of my fever, I was, the ego was sort of going, trying to put an anchor down instead of going on the wave, you know?
Yeah.
Starting to stop everything. Just stop it. I need to understand what's going on here. But you know, it's much better if you don't try to understand things. This is not a head space. You know, for me, I'm so often in my head, and pregnancy is so much about the body.
I feel like this extracts very well to other situations as well. Like, it's not just pregnancy.
Pregnancy is metaphor. That's the next episode.
So I had written some things that are still fairly metaphorical. Should I share some of them with you?
Yeah.
Yes. So somehow I keep going back to this this quote from the Gospel of Thomas: if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you.
Yes.
And even though this is not literally about pregnancy, it always evokes images of pregnancy in my mind.
To bring forth something. Oh, that's another part of my notes. Pregnancy is education. Educere. Mm-hmm. To bring forth something potentially present.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. But it just makes me think of, and I guess I'm like veering a little bit into the pregnancy as metaphor here, but the idea that there is something already growing inside me. Mm. And that it will have to be brought forth or else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then the faith aspect there is like what you're saying, to cooperate with the process, and that I will have a transformation through it and therefore be saved, as per this quote. And if I do not cooperate with it, as you're saying, if the ego tries to put down an anchor and prevent the process out of fear or whatever, then that will jam the process in such a way that it will destroy a part of me.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. The ego wants to put down an anchor because it doesn't know what to do when it's not in control, and it feels like it's not in control. Yeah. So that's the another faith part, that you are not in control. Someone else or something else or something else is in control. Faith is the idea that it will be okay. Even if you are not in control, it will be okay.
Mm-hmm. And here also in my notes, I had also written something about, this is not in my hands, you know, in pregnancy, the process is, I can cooperate, like you're saying, I can help it along, but the process itself, the core of it is not in my hands, and it's the body doing what it is meant to do, and genes doing what they have been doing. And so it's like, even though it is your own body, and your consciousness inside that body, there is something else going on that you're sort of along for the ride, quote unquote.
Yeah. And it's funny how we say my body, your body, because it's we talk about it as a product or a compartment or something that's not doesn't equal my mind.
Yeah, it's a vehicle.
Yeah, but my mind, but thinking about how the baby has agency, but no, no sort of self, like self as in the mechanism that organizes identity, and you know, like, you know, the baby's self is underdeveloped when it comes out, but it's sort of it still has agency. So the agency is also in the mind, is also in the body. I find this really interesting. The mind and the body.
Or like prenatal memories, things that get imprinted. You know, have you ever read about this? It does connect a little bit with what we were saying last time about, you know, the schizoid character and things like that.
Oh,
but
yes.
There's a budding area of research that looks into people actually having memories, not just in utero, but even from the moment of conception.
What is really cool. Yeah.
What
is having the memory? Like, where is the...
Exactly. Yeah. I have no idea. and I don't think we do yet, but there be people having memories of things that they couldn't have heard, but it was in their ears, you know, hearing the voices or hearing the thing going on. But it was happening very early in the pregnancy. There was no way that they could remember.
Here you go. It's not as simple as they have made us believe, you know?
No.
Hearing is not just ears.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. There was no ears yet, but yet here was this, you know, children or adolescents who were struggling with these memories. And so it's just really interesting that went into the self. And had to do with agency and had to do with something that is in the body that has nothing to do with this construct that we're talking about of consciousness in the way that we think about it.
I have here another thing. Suddenly I found in my own bookshelf, I had completely forgotten about it, but it's a Swedish philosophy magazine. This is number 3 from 2016. And it says, are you ready? That's the big question. And the one of the key concepts here is they have interviewed a philosopher called Laurie Paul, who talks about her idea is that you can't really call it a choice whether you want to have children or not. Yeah, because the choice part of it is that we base the choice on, yes, I want to have a child, or no, I don't want to have a child, on the idea of what I would be as a parent, how I would be as a parent. And this is something you you don't know. And they have interviewed a lot of people, and they all have one thing in common. They say, you have feelings that you didn't know you could have.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, that's what they all say.
Tell us about these feelings. What kind of feelings are they?
That's the funny part. It seems to be the feelings that you don't, you couldn't really put words to.
Uh-huh.
We hate those things, don't we? The ego hates the things that you can't put words to. One of the people here says, it's a man, 35-year-old man, and he says, before my kids were born, I'm just like reading in Swedish and simultaneously saying it in English. If it sounds weird, that's why.
Okay.
Yeah. Before they were born, one of my biggest experiences of beauty itself was when I stood on a top of a mountain, sweaty, tired, and tired in a psychic and physical way, but still very satisfied and enjoying the nature. I had no idea what my children's existence would mean to me. And these previous feelings of beauty itself are so puny in comparison with the feelings that I have towards my children. Now they're mine, and they give me every day this feeling of beauty that I can't compare to anything else.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and this is what they all seem to say, these feelings, and then they compare it to something else that they used to think was very big. And they say it's not like that anymore. But they all have variants of can't put words to it. It's unspeakable, etc. And this is also how I feel about the actual birth giving, because already now it's only been three weeks and one day. And already now it's like I can retell the story of how it happened and when and what times, but it's like I'm sort of recounting this farce that I have seen. I know that it was me, but it's not like I know that it really hurt. I know that I remember saying like, oh yeah, like I told my friend, I kept saying to the nurse, I don't think I can do it because it hurts so much. And she said, oh, of course you can't, but I was expecting like 10 hours of pain, and it was way less than that. But the way I don't remember it in my body, like I remember when I try to, if I tell someone what it's like to have a migraine, I cringe a little bit, and I go like, oh, you know, it's like the memory of the pain is in my gestures, and you can really feel that if you look at me, you can know that I hate migraines, you know, and I'm really fearful of having one again, etc. But this is sort of, I can tell the story like I'm like, oh, you know, it's quite crazy. So this is also experiences that you don't have words for suddenly.
I hear you. Wow. And having not had that experience of birth myself, I will not know unless until I do.
Exactly. Yeah, and then you'll forget, apparently.
Yeah, which is why we're doing this.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, that is fascinating. It's just fascinating because it's like a secret club. But once you're in the secret club, you forget what it's like to be in the secret club.
Yeah, and you forget that it is a secret club, and you just go and you don't even notice. I remember when I had my big daughter 10 years ago, I remember one day I took the bus to the city. Did I say this last time? Stop me if you have heard this before and I'll edit it out. But I was on the bus and I looked out and I saw this woman with like three kids in various ages. And I just thought she did this three times.
Wow. No, you didn't say that last time.
Oh, good. Yeah. I also have a colleague at work. And she has three kids. And I told her that I was like, the first time I met her, and she said, the first time we talked about it, she was like, no, I have three kids in these ages. And I'm like, three? you've given birth three times, you know, like I couldn't really believe it. And she just giggled, you know, she was like, yeah, yeah, I did. And so did she, you know, pointing at another colleague. And my grandma had 10 kids.
Yeah.
Like doing this 10 times.
It's like you just, it becomes like a non-issue at that point, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose.
It's just this thing that you do.
It's just this thing that you're always doing. Now I'm pregnant again. It's insane that we don't talk more about it.
Absolutely. Especially like that you're bringing up those feelings, those unnameable feelings, because I think they're missing from the conversation, probably because they're so hard to articulate, but still they deserve a place, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, they deserve a place. And I just recently read about the, you know, these happiness indexes, and now Finland is the world's happiest country. They passed Denmark from last year, or whatever, you know, these indexes that pop up in the news sometimes. And one of the things they usually ask in these happiness indexes is whether you have a child or whether you have small children. And it usually there's a correlation between being unhappy and having small children. Probably because you feel like a bad parent a lot of the time because you're screaming and shouting and you know, they don't listen to you. You know, but I'm joking. But yeah, the other side should not be forgotten.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. It's just being portrayed as children are hard. You're going to mess them up somehow and they take away your free time.
Yeah, exactly. They take and it's work, and you'll fail at it.
Yeah, exactly. It's not so rewarding, and they might hate you in the end anyways.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they'll hate you. They'll leave you. You know, you won't sort of get to reap the rewards of your hard work or whatever. You see what I'm saying? Like it's not a normal project.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting. What your words bring to mind right now is it's kind of directly related to pregnancy and also much broader than that, which is the whole process of attachment. And I'm very, very interested in the topic of attachment and attachment disorders and so on, because I see it in my work a lot, and I see people who maybe don't know that they have issues with attachment. And just recently I was watching a video explaining the process of rupture and repair. So basically the idea that in any given relationship, we will have moments of not getting along or not understanding each other or missing the cue so that we can't be there for the other. And in an ideal situation, we have repair afterwards where we, you know, come back together and explain what happened and get closer together for having had that rupture. And so I was just thinking about the faith aspect of that and looking at it from the perspective of birth, you know, which in a way, I don't know, it's at least it's been portrayed in popular culture a bit that way, that, you know, the baby is safe and warm and comfortable inside the womb and then all of a sudden has to go out into the harsh world. And that's like the ultimate rupture.
Oh, yeah. Yes, yes. Yeah. Lacan and some other psychoanalysts would agree.
Yes. That's where I was thinking about. And so the faith happens in the hope or the possibility that after this giant rupture, there will still be togetherness, there will still be attachment, there will still be bonding with mom, and there will still be nourishing on the other side and safety and so on. So it's like I was in the ultimate safe space and I had to come out, and it is this harsh, unwelcoming space probably, you know. But there is a faith that there's somebody there on the other side for me, which is, in your case, you know, you.
Yeah. With this little baby, I think she was done with being in the safe space in the womb, and she wanted to continue on the outside. And it was, funny enough, It also, they also said that the placenta was quite small.
Interesting.
So I know. And she was also quite small. And now she's grown like 6 centimeters in 3 weeks, which I wonder if that's possible. Maybe they didn't get the measurements right when she was born. But she does really feel a lot bigger. This is another thing.
In the picture you sent, I was like, wow, she's so tiny.
Yes. Yeah, she really was tiny. Very, very tiny. Much, much bigger now. Just 3 weeks. It's crazy. And why is she bigger? I'm going jumping from thing to thing. But it's the breastfeeding, which is also the second part of the body experience of pregnancy. You know, it just continues when the baby is out. And like one of my friends just wrote a text message. She said, isn't it somehow very wonderful, this period? Because at no other time in your life will you have such clear-cut tasks. Your task now is to create food for this baby. You know exactly what you need to do, and this is your job right now. And it's true. It's never so never so obvious what I need to do. In every delivery room, there's this big sign about with 10 things that you should do during the first 24 hours after the child is born. It's like this beautiful picture with a happy baby and stuff. And one of them is to be skin on skin with the baby. Yeah, skin on skin for the first 24 hours, nonstop, all the time. Yeah. This is not what it was like when I was born.
No, neither for me, no.
Yeah.
Yes, so that's our rupture in a way. It's like we're all carrying to different degrees the scars, I guess, or the leftovers of that kind of rupture that maybe never got repaired. I had a thought on that too, which was, you know, you probably also know this, the fact that, you know, biologically speaking, human babies are not really fully done gestating really when they're born. And sort of the idea is that for the large head, like the large cranium that we have, if the baby were to finish doing its, you know, being ready for the outside world inside the womb, then we could not give birth to them because the brain, the head would be too big. And so it strikes me that that's another sort of biological or evolutionary kind of faith. It's like we're going to, when to pause the process, mid-process, get the baby out, and then have faith that it will finish its development process fully and safely.
And that parents are able to take care of this completely vulnerable little being who can not do anything on its own. I'm just thinking of, I have this image of the Stone Age, you know, that they managed all of them, exactly all of them, because everyone who's alive now is a descendant. So they all succeeded, like all of our ancestors.
Yeah.
Every single one of your ancestors.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling to think about.
Yeah.
And so it just highlights for me this, like, there's a whole other process, whether conscious or intelligent or not, you know, whether it's an emergent process, it's an intelligent design or whatever, there is a process that takes over, that has a mind of its own in a sense. And it's incredibly creative to say, okay, well, we would normally have a gestation process of, let's say, you know, 18 months, but this time we're going to cut it at 9, get the baby to get out, and then it has to continue developing. It needs skin on skin, it needs breastfeeding every, you know, so often and so on, so that it can finish its process.
And the breastfeeding is another, and it's a very interesting topic, because the breast milk is this miracle fluid that you can sort of, the nurse said, oh yeah, you know, and if the baby's bottom gets red from the wearing diapers too much, you can also just like squeeze out a bit of breast milk and put it on the skin. And it's really, you can do anything. Oh, if the baby is snotty, you can take one drop of breast milk and put it in its nose.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's incredible. Nobody talks about this.
No, this, I'm just like right now, like images are flashing before my eyes of all the menus.
Yeah. This is the forbidden stuff in the world where, you know, all women are, woman is sexualized, and this is not what you do with breasts. You know, they are egging the man. This, it's quite, I really, it's very, very good that we're having this conversation. I think it sort of fits, well, maybe I'll edit this out too, but it fits very well with the Me Too thing going on, and you know, everything that's happening.
It's, in a sense, for me, it just comes across as a super common sense reminder, like just really down to earth. It's like, this is what our body is for. Yes, there is a sexual pleasure aspect, but ultimately there is this whole other dimension that we're forgetting about. It's like, you know, one aspect is of course the sexism aspect, but there's this just a forgetfulness in it. If that makes any sense whatsoever, I don't know.
Forgetting like, the purpose.
Yeah, if we talk about it more, then we can remember that this is actually very down to earth, very common sense. Yes, we make babies and we feed them with these breasts, and we make magical fluid that can keep them healthy and well. And this is what, you know, this is the whole other dimension, and it's potentially way more interesting than, you know, using boobs to sell things.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The body just does it. Oh, yeah. I see another note here. I've written, a scientist's way to a new discovery is a so-called rational vision, which where the idea is that it's a, like in connection to faith. So the idea is that you first have a as a scientist, you don't go about just testing anything blindly in the world and collecting the data. That would be unproductive. Mm-hmm. But you have an idea of how, of like a question or something that you need to find the answer to, or something you wonder.
Yes.
But it's a rational vision. You can imagine that it's something that you could be answered. You remember Einstein's what would it be like to sit on a beam of light? You know, this is it's a kind of rational vision kind of thing. So this is also the in pregnancy you also have these images of, I wonder what my child will be like, you know?
Yeah.
And you imagine, you know, and you have to have some sort of, it's visionary because it's not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got to be, if you imagine that your child will be both win the Nobel Prize for Literature and set the world record for X, Y, and Z, it's no longer very rational, but...
yeah, I hear you. It's there's like there's again another sort of like, it's a vision, but it has common sense in it. It has a groundedness in, you know, possible realities and information from the past to inform the future.
Yeah, and the faithful aspect is that it's in fact visionary, that you have made an attempt to. Like it's creative. It's you've made an attempt to create a future.
Yes.
All of pregnancy is obviously very creative.
Mm-hmm. And it just makes sparks in my mind this saying that I've heard many times in relation to Native communities in the Americas who talk about doing something for the sake of the next seven generations.
And the next seven.
Yes. Yes, the next seven. So this, the idea or the ideal, the way that I have been explained to, is that when you have a big decision to make, whether in your personal life or as a collective, as a, you know, as a village, as a tribe, whatever, you think about what the possible consequences will be for the next seven generations. And so there, to the best of your ability to imagine what's going to happen in seven generations, you make the decision based on that.
Mm.
And so it connects for me what you're saying, the idea that you creatively, you know, you become pregnant creatively and imagine a future for human beings. And this is, you know, and this is your part in contributing to that future. You will not only have a baby, you will raise that baby to the best of your abilities. So that's, you know, that is a very different kind of faith, in the sense that it doesn't leave everything to chance per se.
Yeah, the but active it's this, faith.
Yes, you know? It's a co-creative process of, okay, I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but here are my skills, here's my commitment, here's my determination, and I will stand by that future at every step.
I will stand by that future. Very nice. Here is a quote from Eric Fromm. My faith in myself, in another, in humankind, in our capacity to become fully human, also implies certainty, but certainty based on my own experience and not on my submission to an authority that dictates a certain belief. Blah, blah, blah. The Hebrew word for faith is emunah, which means certainty. Amen means certainly. Isn't this nice?
It's Amen. Perfect.
Yeah. So, may this happen, certainly, you know.
Yeah.
And this is also to become fully human. I've just recently read a book on this PAC method, this parent, adult, child, and how you relate to other people as an adult. Because the in this model, the parent voice is kind of like your like the Freudian superego voice. Yeah, the nasty one that tells you you're doing things wrong and this is the way it should be, you know? So so this is for after pregnancy you become parent, but please not this kind of parent. I've noticed a lot of this nasty parent in myself lately. Not a nice experience, but very good to read a book so I can get over it and become an adult instead. So this is another part of it. Now we have, and the adult aspect is also in every child, obviously, will become stronger. Maybe it's not very strong when you're a baby, but the adult aspect is the one that can talk about the thing at hand, instead of just being informed by your previous mental states with regard to this. Like you can say, for instance, you can ask someone, have you seen my keys, or where are my keys, or whatever. And there are different ways to respond to this, like as a child, or as a parent, or as an adult. So the parent would probably answer, why don't you keep track of your things? You
know, yes.
This is... Again, you don't know where you put your keys. Or the child might say, I don't know. I don't want to have to think about where you put your keys.
Yeah.
And the adult would just say, no, I don't know where they are.
Right. It's just like a factual statement.
Yes, a factual statement. And where you are responding to what's actually being asked. So you've sort of made this, it's a very conscious way of understanding language too, you know. You realize now we're in this language level of things, so we're exchanging words. We don't have to exchange our entire psychological history and all the things that have been hurting in me since I was a child, you know.
Correct,
So this is my faith in our capacity to become fully human implies certainty based on my own experience.
Yes.
Yes. Amen. Amen to that.
Yeah. And so is the connection that you're making related to the faith that a child will become an adult and...
That it can work, you know?
That it can work and that it will not be crippled by the negative parent.
Yes, and that we don't have to, I'll just make it a positive statement instead.
Yeah.
So that we can be active, we can be agents, we can have active faith, we don't have to have this passive, submissive trust, you know?
Yeah.
that we can, it's possible. I can just feel my spine going more straight when I start talking like this. It's just so, I'm building myself, firing myself up a little bit. I feel so positive about this. You know, I feel so positive about the future. You know, it'll work. It's going to work. I can see that this new child is, this new person is very strong, very eager to live and to be here and to do things and to function.
Yeah. Well, that's heartening. Like, really, really. I can just feel it off of you while talking to you. This glow of yes, we can do this.
Yeah, I'm the you know, the strengthening your biceps emoticon. That's me, right?
Yes, exactly. And you know, parallel to all this that we're saying, I'm hearing like it's like faith is partnered with sovereignty. It's like if faith does not come alone, and faith does not come as a subservience to another process or being. It comes with sovereignty. So it's like I am in my sovereign space. I am free and autonomous, and this other being that is within me, that now is out of me, is also autonomous, and we have faith in each other's sovereignty.
Yeah, this is the wonderful both-and-ness of life, you know? It's actually very simple. We're both sovereign and connected forever, you know?
Yeah.
Completely and forever.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah, I'm just quickly going to find the thing that I didn't. Laurie Paul. Okay, I'm freestyling a little bit. There will be some editing later. Man is in a knowledge theoretical darkness. Kunskapsteoretiskt mörker in Swedish. She writes in Transformative Experience, her book. We can't know what change our children's existence will mean for us, our lives, our brains, our hearts, our feelings. The question about whether or not to have a child embraces the unknown in life and the possibility to change. So this is also the active faith that you choose, Laurie Paul says, you choose to become a parent to discover who you will become. Yeah. So this is the, what could that be? I want to say active faith again, but that's all I'm saying. Apparently,
active faith.
Nothing else.
What is that?
Intellectual curiosity.
Yeah, like an openness to that which is not known, impossibly not knowable beforehand.
And also the rational vision kind of thing, because you wouldn't do it if you believed that you would kill your children, or that you would do something terrible to them. You're interested in discovering who you will become, because you think that it might be something, you know, it will evolve you. You will grow. It will mean growth, and growth as in, you know, new branches on a tree. You know.
Yeah. Here's like a little bit of an opposing perspective. I'm just going to ask you, like, how many people do you think make the choice really consciously, knowing or with some awareness of this in mind, versus maybe just, I'm just saying just with quotation marks, just rationalizing the instinct to procreate?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I think it's very, very hard to tell. I'm stating the obvious now. I think that it's easy to want to have a child because you want to be the opposite of your own parents, or because you want to be exactly how your own parents were. So both of these reasons are not to do very much with the child,
right?
Who's coming and who you don't. Nobody knows, and who you will have to be flexible to accommodate.
Yeah.
So to see yourself as parent is one thing.
Yeah, I think it's curious because, of course, you and many other people are approaching parenting from a very conscious perspective and making a conscious choice and asking conscious questions. And many other people are in a process in their lives where they might be making choices unconsciously as a reaction, like what you're saying, I'm not going to be like my parents, or as a reaction to uncertainty itself. I don't know what my life is going to be like, but if I'm a parent, then I'm on the right track, or something like that.
That's reactionary rather than actionary, so to speak.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's not real agency.
No.
This is why we need more philosophy in schools and everywhere.
And particularly of pregnancy.
Yes. And of sort of philosophy. I'm writing this text now, where one of the main questions is sort of, or the main inspirational sentences is that philosophy is about the question of what to do.
This
is why we need philosophy.
Yeah, because it's been portrayed as just useless thinking in some places.
For people who have too much time, you know, who have nothing really important to do, like getting food on the table, you know.
Yeah.
This like a rich white Western pastime.
Yeah. Well, that all just brings me back to the whole your sentence about pregnancy as education.
Philosophical practice is also education. You know, when I did my philosophical counseling course in New York, they specifically told us to for tax purposes we should call it educational practice and not
exactly.
Which is very nice. It's because as opposed to sort of therapy or something like that.
Yeah,
therapy for the sane. That's what Andrew Marinoff, my teacher, said.
Oh, that's beautiful.
it's very good.
Yeah. So it's like, while in the experience of it, becoming not just bringing forth the child, but also bringing forth all the unconscious material in our own minds to understand what it is to be a parent.
Yes. And bringing forth yourself as adult and as an adult parent, not in the PAC model parent, but who can you be as a leader of new beings? I used to have this thought experiment when I was 10 or something. That, you know, if someone from the 18th or 19th century came here, what would I show them? And, you know, how would I explain what things are? The telephone and these high tech things that we had in the 18th and 90s. But who would you be? Who would you be as a leader? And who would you be as a teacher, as a leader, as a parent, as someone who helps these new beings understand how we interact with each other, what society is, and what societal rules mean, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how you explain things like all the implicit things that we all agree on, like you don't fart at the dinner table or how you explain why we do these things and to make them conscious so that we avoid being these reactionary people who don't have agency and who wake up one day and say, oh my God, I'm 70 years old. I don't know whose life I've been living. You know,
I love that we can look at it like that, and that even such a simple viewing point shift can change the whole meaning of it from, you know, parenting as authoritarian or as imprinting with things that aren't yours into a leadership of introduction to this planet.
Yes. Yeah. And the superbly strong insight that the children are the future. They are going to do this. we need to give them everything we have to to prepare them and to help them and to set the stage.
Isn't that like just such a powerful also reframe of the way that society treats parents, particularly mothers? You know, it's like, of course, it has been said before, you know, being a mom is doing this, or being a parent is doing this, what you're saying, giving all the tools so that the child will be the adult of the future and do the best they possibly can on this planet. And yet, it's for, by so many, it's being done as a, you know, as a side job or as a thing that is, you know, like, I have my career and I have my kids on the side, and it's just, I guess it doesn't feel like such an honored work, work position or leadership position.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up. Or, because you can also give your kids away to a nanny or whatever. You can avoid being with them quite easily and quite a lot if you like. I sound like I sound like a sort of Christian Democrat who wants to, but this is kind of, you know, it's very easy to get into that mode when you have a tiny little baby here, because I just want to be with her all the time, not exactly all the time, but you know, many, you know, not exactly this hour because I'm busy now talking to you.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's something to be harvested there. It's like there's this, you know, in the first conversation we had, you talked about the honor and the mantle of, now I am pregnant, now I am a mother, and taking that in, and I feel like this is the next level of that.
Yes, now I have, I'm like the bird who hides the offspring under my wing. I'm like, oh no, there's nothing here. You know, predators? No, not at all.
Nothing to see here.
Go away, keep going. but really, I'm grooming her all the time, getting her the nicest worms.
Oh, that's great. Although when you said that, I also pictured those fish that hide their offspring inside their mouth.
Inside the mouth. Oh, yeah. Yes. I'm that too.
I have other thoughts, but I don't know if they branch too far afield from the faith perspective.
We can bring them back to faith.
We can bring them back to faith. Well, because we were talking about parenting as leadership, and I'm very interested in whatever we can glean from Paleolithic perspectives and, you know, like prehistoric perspectives on parenting. Like, that's a whole other can of worms. But there's a woman called Jean Lidloff. I don't know if you've ever heard of her. She wrote a book called The Continuum Concept. I think she wrote it maybe in the 80s or early 90s. Don't quote me on that. But basically, she had a chance to visit a tribe in the Americas, in Central America, and they and live with them and experience their way of life. And she noticed that they practiced what we would now call attachment parenting. So basically, like what you said, skin to skin, all the time, babies in arms, at all times, until the child said or, you know, manifested the will to be put down, or wanting to go play by itself or explore by itself. And so she was struck by the fact that the child rearing practices were so different from the Western ones that she was used to. You know, parents co-sleeping with their children, you know, just carrying them everywhere, not separating them from life. So basically, when the children were a little older, they were involved in all the tasks of the tribe, and everything included the children. And she was surprised to find that the children were very quiet, very little crying, very happy. You know, so she started digging into this and articulated it for a Western audience. So this continuum concept, parenting, now actually articulates all this as parental leadership. So exactly what you said about showing the child around and introducing them to what like in society. But that doing so would... The children actually expect that leadership, and that when in the Western world we give our children too many choices and put them in the position of leadership, like, what do you want to do?
Yeah,
or
I know.
Do you want to buy this, or do you want to get that? All that stuff, it actually creates extreme anxiety, and then the children start acting out.
Yeah, yes, very true. Yeah, yes, there are
so.
I was just thinking of these shows, you know, the Super Nanny or whatever they're called.
Yeah.
You know, and you can see these, or the Dog Whisperer, even.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a need for like reliance on that leadership, and I guess maybe that's where the faith piece comes in. It's like there is a two-way street. A parent has faith that the child comes with everything it needs inside to thrive, to grow, both biologically and psychologically. And the child has this absolute faith in the parent, that the parent knows what to do on this planet and will show them.
Yes, exactly. It's an imperative. The pregnancy as faith is means that you have to have this faith. You have to have this faith that because your child relies on you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's like, they have faith.
Yeah, they have faith, but then you also, it's like it's an Ouroboros in a way. If you take one piece away, then everything falls apart. Because if the parent has no faith, then they will act out of doubt and confused and controlling or whatever, and then break the cycle.
It's so easy to break the cycle. It's so difficult to have faith. You have to remind yourself. I wish it was easier. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No. I don't imagine it at all as anything simple or straightforward.
And we've been moved so far from... We've moved so far out in our heads. I mean, at least I have. I think it's... Yeah, and it's difficult to find the connection back. At least for me, it's been like that. And it also, I think it's, you know, Western society at large. Basically, my mom just told me the other day that when she had me and my sister, I'm a twin, she was told to sort of clean her nipples with this special thing before feeding us.
Oh.
Yeah, and so maybe that's why I have allergies, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, and now they didn't even, when my daughter was born, they just sort of put her in a blanket, and then I held her in this blanket for 24 hours, and then another one, obviously, because it was a little bit dirty, but they didn't sort of wash her or nothing like that, you know.
Yeah,
everything
yeah.
was there, all the birth mess.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's also a whole what do you call it, like an inoculation that needs to happen with all your microbiome onto her.
Now we know these things.
Yeah,
you know, now we do, and apparently before we didn't, because these you know, they are, women were supposed to give birth lying on their backs, which is sort of the worst position possible for birth giving.
Yes,
and it was like that for a long time, because it was God, it makes me angry to just think about how stupid this is.
Oh, I hear you. Same.
Yeah. So stupid.
Isn't it interesting, though, since you introduced the idea of the ego needing control and wanting control, these practices of giving birth in a certain position and disinfecting things and, you know, like cleaning your nipples or whatever else, other examples there might be, have been examples of trying to control a process that is inherently messy, but beneficial because of that. But we didn't know.
Yeah, you discover germs, so you discover something to take them away. And then many years later and many deaths and allergies later, you discover, oh, wait, germs, we need them. They were good germs. We just needed to put them, keep them in the place where they were originally. You know, it's not good to move mouse germs to another part of the body, for instance, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But they, as long as they are in the place where they were, they are doing a job.
Yeah.
Very well.
In a sense, and I'm sure also many practitioners in their time, which have who have been forgotten over time, must have said this.
Yes.
This, you know, this, well, if it's there, there must be a reason, which is a kind of faith.
Yeah, I was just thinking, it's lack of faith to want to take them away, you know?
Yeah.
To want to clean your nipples before you feed your child. This is lack of faith, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and since we have since discovered that there's this whole interchange that happens between the child's saliva and the nipple that creates a whole chemical reaction that tailors the milk to their needs, I can't imagine what putting some kind of chemical in there would do to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
And
yeah, so it's like what you said before. It's like our ancestors managed and they succeeded. So there must have been something there that allowed them to succeed even without all these technological approaches.
This is the faith we lost, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Faith we lost in the Industrial Revolution or whatever.
Mm.
And now we're finally regaining it again. And it's changed in 10 years because they did. I was a little bit surprised now when 3 weeks ago. Because they didn't do that. She was just born and they gave, you know, I held her and they said, oh, okay, so a skin on skin for the first 24 hours. And then we, you know, all the other stuff that we were talking about. But 10 years ago when my big daughter was born, they sort of took her away. They put her in there. They weighed her. They counted her toes and fingers, you know, in the instant she was born.
Yeah.
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 And for 3 weeks ago, and this my second daughter, they only weighed her after several hours.
Mm, I'm glad.
Yeah.
I'm glad for her.
Yeah.
And for you.
Yes. Yeah. I think, you know, it's good. We're going somewhere. We're regaining this lost faith. I mean, I am too, I hope. All this is a process of regaining lost faith, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, I hope it's okay that this particular conversation turned out to be more opinionated than the first one.
Of course it is.
Yeah, good. Because I personally do have very strong feelings about all these things, and I can hear that you do too.
Indeed, strong feelings are all part of a process of regaining lost faith. Well, I'm fine with that. Our third and last episode is on pregnancy as metaphor, airing shortly. Till then, do visit philoprax.com, that's philoprax.com, and leave a comment if you like. Till soon then, all the best.